Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend Matt Westmiller here with me today. Matt, how are you this morning?
Doing well, Nick. How are you doing?
It's another day in paradise. Thanks for asking. We're
Yeah.
having a nice, it's a beautiful day. Really, really happy that that it hasn't gotten like stupid hot here in the DC area again. So it's beautiful day, gorgeous. Really appreciate you coming on. So Matt, for everybody that doesn't have the opportunity to know you yet, you mind just telling folks like a little bit about yourself, your background, your story, and kind of how you got here?
Yeah, of course. Well, I appreciate you having me on, Nick. And yeah, certainly appreciate a good conversation and looking forward to what we have to discuss today. Yeah, my background comes, I work counterintelligence for the United States Army. Did that and then worked counterintelligence for a various number of other agencies along the civilian sector. But mostly my counterintelligence experience resided within research and technology protection. That's really where my career trajectory really landed me into where I'm currently at now, and supporting private sector and actually working with different software solutions for a company called Orbis Operations, where we're using AI-enabled software to be able to empower any of the analysts out in the intelligence defense communities to be able to help with their workflow efficiencies and use AI to the advantage now of everything that we have in technology, being able to help and improve our workflows and efficiencies.
Awesome, man. No, I know that any but you're first, thank you for your service. Also thank you for working so hard to protect our critical infrastructure. Yeah, today we're talking about AI and critical infrastructure and the intersection of the two and how, frankly, unless you secure the entire supply chain that supports the AI infrastructure, like any of these fancy apps that work on top of it, whether it's Gemini, ChatGPT, Claude, you name them, all the workflow stuff you're doing, none of that works without the foundational infrastructure that is critical to our nation's security. And I mean, I know you spent a lot of time working in that, for years and years. But like, what are some of the biggest misconceptions that the public has about supply chain security, specifically within the defense industries and as it relates to critical infrastructure as well?
Yeah, as it pertains to supply chain, the common misconception is really is it being simple, and it's far from being simple. It's much more sophisticated than that, and there's many layers and different strategies of how you can then be as an adversary, a nation state actor, how you want to be able to manipulate that supply chain and be able to impose any sort of threats or different risks into that. Yeah, so the common misconception would be that it's just shipping routes, and it's very easy to just think or believe that. And that's typically what most people would think when you hear supply chain is transportation of goods, shipping routes, that's it. But that's all while that's just one portion of the supply chain. And that's while everything and all the goods are actually en route. But you're not thinking about anything of all what happens to the left of that. Everything to the left of that before it actually gets on board any sort kind of ship or any kind of container. And what all happens during that process well beforehand. And that's where the sophistication really comes in, all the way down to the rare earth minerals that are being used to construct any of these goods, tangible products that are being shipped. And that's something that we've seen all throughout the intelligence community, defense community, and really what nation state actors such as China and what they've done to be able to get a stranglehold on these rare earth minerals. And now, and once you have that and put into our supply chain, okay, you can now, the world is yours, and being able to then do and whatever you want to be able to manipulate those minerals that you know are going to go into a product later, and it's going to be placed into our supply chain here in the US, or anybody that they're really trying to manipulate their supply chain as well, any of our allies all across the globe. So it gets much more sophisticated, and yeah, there's something well beyond just the standard shipping routes that you have to be concerned about. And that's for the tangible products, not even going into also software assurance. And you're talking about supply chain when it comes to that, and you're embedding now third-party software engineers and different people that are all within that supply chain from different tool from different companies, different countries, and you have all this, and you got to be able to understand of who is within that supply chain, who has input any kind of code into the software. because it's important then once it gets to the end user, okay, what is the ultimate product that we have now received? And yeah, you got to be able to scan those still for vulnerabilities and conduct your due diligence to be able to understand what it is now that you actually have at your desktop.
Yeah, man. No, that's like, first, I appreciate the overview. That's how you said, that was a lot. Like, I know we're talking like, first, there's the tangible physical products, right? Where we're talking like from, you know, somebody's mining or like mining the raw materials that are then refined in turned into these goods that are then moved on, like maybe on ships, maybe, you know, on, you know, around the country. But I think like for the rare earth piece, I think that I read that China produces like 90 to 95% of the world's rare earth minerals. Do you see a problem on like over-reliance on somebody that is, you know, like not like a geopolitical adversary controlling that much of such a critical resource?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a huge issue. And when you look at it economically, and when you're able to tie that in, how much that is well integrated in with our national security. When it comes to manufacturing our defense products, any of our weapon systems, and they depend upon these rare earth minerals, and now you're inflicting additional costs. And tariffs have been a huge talk and discussion lately. And when you're a country now that you have that much of a hold on rare earth minerals, and now you're looking to export, you can charge whatever that you want if there's a demand for it. And that's where you face these economical risks that then impose certain risks and everything on national security. And certainly a lot of implications that come with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's the physical side, right? And then you brought up software as well and the supply chain around that. And I mean, I think, now correct me if I'm wrong, I think that a lot of these apps have like, you know, applications that have been developed are first developed, you know, largely like there's teams all over the world that can be a part of it, especially as you look at like the global workforce. And that can be an issue, I'm sure. But second, also, you know, not like we're also talking about with AI around data and how data is the lifeblood of AI. And you know, we also need to have supply chain and custody of the data and understand who touched it, who like, you know, who not just touched it, but who organized it, who oh God, what's the word? Who like did all the data tagging to categorize it so the AI can understand. And so it just, I mean, that's a huge complex issue, man. That's massive.
Yeah, and I like what you say about data tagging and also and how AI, yeah, it just works off the data that it's been trained with. And if you are working with an AI model and you are now in that construction phase and the development phase of building this AI model, well, take a look at the data that is being injected into the model. You have to be able to understand, is there any kind of data that is disinformation or misinformation or supposed to purposely mislead somebody, and the AI models then pulling from that. And that would be data poisoning to where you're essentially just feeding this AI model with poor information for the purpose of whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. But the end user, they're going to get delivered the output, and whatever they had prompted, they're going to get an output that is based on the instructions that somebody had preset into this model. And if those are all, yeah, manipulated before it gets to the user, and the user doesn't go to inspect any of that, then it certainly runs into a number of issues there.
Right. Garbage in, garbage out, just like everything, right? If you're being, you know,
Right.
if it's trained on crappy data, it's going to give you crappy results. And so looking at all that. And so what are the, you know, as we talk about this like massively complex problem, what are the weakest links when as you look at securing these sensitive systems?
It's always a human. A human is always going to be the weakest link. And we have great technology, and we look at our cloud infrastructure and all the apps that are embedded into our cloud systems. And you look at something like AWS and so many different applications that are continuously running and sending credentials for identity and access management through different apps to be able to authenticate the user. It's very well secure and it's very hard and difficult. And AWS and other cloud services alike have made it that way, of course, because they know the threats and implications. And there's very sophisticated cyber threat actors that are out there to go and penetrate their systems. But it's a lot easier for the adversary to begin and start with the user and be able to obtain their identity and access management credentials to be able to get into the system and be able to navigate freely after they have been able to essentially confiscate those user credentials through any number of ways and reasons, such as like a simple phishing email.
Absolutely. So what are the like common ways that these actors go and approach these folks? Like is it all, as you mentioned, phishing attacks where you get like an email that looks legit but isn't legit and it came from the wrong place? Like I know that's a huge thing. Like one of my companies, we've had a whole, like in the medical space, whole bunch of phishing attacks, and somebody actually got once, which was, crazy to me. But hey, I'm not the normal person when it comes to security, I guess. Like how do you approach these folks? Is it mainly that, or do you like are there actually people going out and like offering bags of cash?
Not necessarily just starting with the bags of cash. There's a lot more that goes, oh, you can certainly do that and see if it works. But a lot more that goes into it if you're working a sophisticated operation, being able to find and identify the right users. But this is exactly a lot of what I worked with in counterintelligence and really where the true start of the threats occur. And really, when you're a nation state actor and you're working for an intelligence organization, or I mean, even just privately too, if you want to have any kind of industrial espionage go on, you want to get to know your competitors. And the best way and easiest way of doing that is LinkedIn. It's literally a playground for all of those people because everybody is placing all information about their entire background, who they worked for, which offices they were particularly assigned with, and a whole description of different projects they were working on. So when we begin talking about data, that's all data and that's all residing right in LinkedIn. And if you're really having enough user of LinkedIn, you know that you can have certain search queries to be able to pull information about people, keywords that you can be able to put in, and that's going to ping against all the different profiles, and you can set additional filters on certain companies that you want to be able to then go and target. So you're able to then now, cast a wide net, but you're able to set so many of those filters and different keywords to be able to narrow in and be able to get exactly who it is that you want to be able to then speak with and get access to information that you want to know about. And that's really how they're going out and doing it. And really, a large part of what we did at counterintelligence is being able to educate the workforce on all the implications and threats that are posed to them, especially working in the defense and intelligence community. And them have to be very careful about what they're actually publicizing on social media, such as LinkedIn, along with many others, or any different forums or podcasts, and making sure that they know and recognize that they're a threat to our organization because of the placement and access to the information that they are privy to. And they're certainly a very great looking target, to put it that way. And they're looking very nice in terms of what it in the perspective for the adversary to then go and target, essentially.
Absolutely. So people will go on like LinkedIn and pull down. And I mean, like I do the same thing in recruiting, right? When I'm recruiting and I'm like trying to poach somebody or trying to find people that worked on a specific program, if you know who the incumbent is, then you can like filter by like, whether it's in the recruiting or the sales, like add-ons that we have organizationally, like you can go in and like filter by company, when people work there, by job title, and then kind of work backwards from there to figure out like who do I need to talk to. So I'm sure that like sophisticated nation states with intelligence services are doing that, but at a much, much higher level. After they identify folks, are they reaching out to them like personally or via e like how does it the whole thing work, or is it like there's a whole is it like essentially they have pipelines of different approaches for different people?
And there's a lot of different TTPs, techniques, tactics, procedures that these adversaries go and use. And it could be any number of reasons from once they actually identify and detect, okay, this would be a good asset or a good source that we could be able to work with for information to be able to obtain. And they got to be a bit more creative now because of the really the training and education campaigns that have been put out by counterintelligence offices to train the workforce on being able to better identify and detect these emails, because back in the day, this wasn't very widely known, and there wasn't a lot of counterintelligence professionals that were going out training the workforce to be able to then identify, hey, this is a targeting attempt, and this could be potentially somebody, an adversary, somebody that's trying to collect information for nefarious reasons. But it could just be just a simple LinkedIn message and just wanting to connect and being able to have a quick and short discussion. Really, you're going in and you're trying to elicit information, and the power of elicitation is immense, because you're able to truly obfuscate what it is, what your true intentions and purposes are, if you're skilled at being able to guide the conversation. And we call it the hourglass method, to where you're starting very broad and you're being able to then narrow in into the actual topic and conversation that you want to be able to have with this person. And then you broaden back out, and that's what creates the shape of the hourglass. And humans, we tend to recall psychologically in the conversation when we first get to meet somebody, we tend to remember the beginning and the end of the conversation. And yeah, we really don't recall as well the middle of the conversation. And that's right where, yeah, they're going to be discussing everything of what it is that they actually want to get to know. And when they go to broaden out that conversation again, it's back to just simple conversation, day-to-day talk. And that's more what would go on in like an in-person conversation, of course. But yeah, just in the regular inbox, it can happen as well. But yeah, there's been, if people have their information, that the contact information, such as phone or email, that would be a more personal means of them being able to then get directly into your inbox rather than just a LinkedIn instant message, and have a little bit more of a intriguing offer to them, such as, hey, we work for a private company and we're looking to be able to solicit people to help us write information papers. And this could be for academic reasons and purposes for them to be able to work for an overall study group and get paid for it. But these people don't even know or conduct the due diligence to be able to look back and see who this company is, where they actually, what the ties are. And it's not easy to be able to detect that if you're just a regular citizen. That's where you got to be able to work with those intelligence professionals by reporting something like that to be able to, get those resources in to be able to then identify those different ties.
Absolutely. So, I love the hourglass metaphor. That's fascinating. Fascinating that we really just kind of don't remember the middle of conversations, really. That's wild to me. So LinkedIn is a huge source for information. And then I know, you mentioned there's the four motivators, which is, money, ideology, coercion, and ego. Which do you see exploited most, and how, and how are they using them? Like, it's, you know, as like, go ahead.
Money, ideology, coercion, ego, the acronym MICE, which is thrown around in the intelligence community quite often. And really, that's how you're looking at trying to sway somebody into be working as a source or an asset for you. And that's a common principle across all intelligence organizations all across the world. And it goes back into, again, our human psychology. Okay, well, what is it that is going to get somebody to want and work for another nation, and being able to share information that easily put them in jail or behind bars, if they go to disclose it? And yeah, it comes down to money, ideology, coercion, and ego. And a lot of what we see is money and or ego. But now, with really how divided we have become in politics and everything, and certain beliefs, you see a lot of ideology just for polar opposites we're now seeing across really the whole world now. But money and ego are really the two that you see the most. And you're looking at that when you're an intelligence professional and you're trying to get a source to then go and work for you and be able to give you information. Okay, which one of these is it going to be that I would have to then build into the relationship that I have with them, and being able to understand what their motivation is and really why they're here and wanting to build this relationship with me, and how are we going to continue working with one another. And oftentimes you're going to also want to use multiple at your advantage, and they're all working in parallel with one another. To be able to help uplift their ego, to be able to help get them go and do more of what it is that you need them to go and collect, and then also bring in the ideological reasons for the reasons why they might be doing it, and then paying them at the end of the day money to be able to reward them for what it is that they're going after and doing.
Absolutely. So that's when the bags of cash come in. That or like gold bars. I think like the senator from New Jersey was like accepting gold bars. And like I feel like I don't know, man. Like I'm not sure what you would even do with a gold bar. How do you even move that? I'm not sure. I don't have a guy for that, right? So it's kind of crazy to me that you're able to kind of people work their way in. And how do you like how you know how do you train folks? Like what kinds of trainings and awareness are most effective also with this?
Are you talking training in terms of from the intelligence professional or training for like the workforce?
Let's start with the workforce and then let's go to the intelligence professional. I'm curious.
Okay,
That's
yeah.
cool.
So workforce and everything. So yeah, large. So when counterintelligence and everything, where what we're aimed to do and everything is to be able to identify, detect, disrupt, exploit any adversary attempt to be able to collect or gather our information. So think of it as the kind of another intelligence actor. There, we're well. General intelligence gathering is we're wanting to collect information on them. And then counterintelligence, you're building an additional layer to where the adversary, we want to know what information that they know about us. Where are our vulnerabilities? And where are the different areas that the adversary may target our organizations to be able to gather and collect information? And a lot of that is, again, through just standard humans. And that's where the training for our workforce comes in. And yeah, there's a large misconception of what we do at counterintelligence, and the movies and everything, and showcase of it being all very cool. I mean, it's very cool stuff and neat, but it's boring too in terms of what your day-to-day actually looks like to be able to build up to the cool and neat stuff that you see depicted quite often in all the movies. But the boring stuff is it's the most important, and it's training that workforce to be able to identify why, like how they're going to be essentially targeted by these adversaries and why they're a threat. And they're just one piece of the puzzle that is made up of thousands of pieces that the adversary is trying to go after. So yeah, training the workforce on being able to identify really all the threats and the different attempts that adversaries use to be able to then target them, such as what we've talked about already, of them going through LinkedIn and being able to find them that way, or just through conversation and being able to exploit in conversation what it is that they're who they work for and what information that they have access to, and making sure that they're aware of that so they don't become another threat and another whole case study of what we've worked historically, and it leads to an arrest. And there's a lot of people to where they become this insider threat, and you could be a witting insider threat or an unwitting. And a witting is you're knowingly giving information over to the adversary. You know who they work for, and you know exactly what you're doing.
Right.
And
That's
yeah,
like a
you're just
Robert Hansen, right? Because I know Robert Hansen was like the biggest, I think the biggest leaker of all time at the FBI, maybe one of our largest. I think he's still in jail, maybe out.
He had passed back in 2023. He
Okay.
was in solitary confinement. I believe he was arrested in 20 or 2000 or sorry, 2001, placed in solitary confinement, and it was 23 hours of the day he was in solitude, and then 1 hour just kind of open. But
He got
yeah,
arrested right around the corner from my house. Unrelated, just a random fact. Like it's like
yeah.
I didn't know that. It's why and it's crazy when you start like how did he at one point I think he was in charge of the investigation into himself, which is just like I don't know, it's just wild to me.
Yeah, no, it right outside Vienna, Virginia, is where he's arrested. And yeah, he was the lead FBI agent over at FBI's counterintelligence division, and you are in charge of all the counterintelligence professionals that are there to be able to detect insider threats, and you're the insider threat. It's yeah, and it was insane of all the information that he had access to because he had just super user essentially or super admin type privileges to where you have oversight of everything that's going on. And that's where compartmentalization is so significant in being able to segregate and separate people from having at like super admin type oversight into everything. Because if there's one leak like that, it is exceptionally grave damage that then occurs to our national security. And we saw that, and it's unfortunate, but those are situations to where we've learned a lot, and it's now transformed to how we operate in the intelligence community. But yeah, that right there is an example of a witting insider threat. And then you have an unwitting insider threat to where yeah, they don't know, they don't think it's anything bad what it is that they're giving information to. And that's where why I talked about the email before about an academic research paper that they might be getting paid to send information and write different white papers for. They don't know exactly who it's going to. And to their knowledge, they think it's just going to an academic research firm. And yeah, lo and behold, after conducting actual investigation into the ties of the business that had reached out and solicited to them, yeah, it goes right back to China. And you're like, okay, well, they didn't know any better, but it's like, okay, well, there's still some significant problems with that, and they need to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. But that's where, yeah, we need to have that training and education to the workforce for them to be able to know of what it is that they need to do to protect themselves. It goes in with cybersecurity awareness as well, and knowledge to them to not click on the first link and different links without being able to potentially just hover over it and see what the URL goes to. Just simple, I say simple, it's simple to us that are familiar with these principles, but not to the average business person or government employee. So that's why we really have to foot stomp and emphasize all of that and these different training awareness briefings that we deliver to the workforce.
Absolutely. I mean, I know this is like, I mean, you mentioned it's the boring stuff. It's the non-sexy side of the intel world, right? But I'm a military history fan, and I think as you study like military history and you look at it, the non-boring side of war. Like I love the saying that amateurs talk about tactics, professionals talk about logistics. It doesn't matter how good your guns are if you can't get bullets there that they need, and food for your troops. And I mean, this, like, I look at this as like the foundational, like, non-sexy side of the intel world that you're building off of, that is hypercritical and hyper important, because it's like, this is fundamentals, right? Tim Duncan was Mr. Fundamental, but he's still a Hall of Fame player, right? It's fascinating, man.
Yeah,
Super
of course.
interesting. So I know right now, like, there's a lot that goes into people doing this. Do you think that this is going to scale? Like, are they going to start, they being Intel World, and I'm sure we already are, using like AI to essentially scale their outreach in ways to essentially touch more people and touch more targets?
Yeah, so I won't speak about in terms of offensively of how our intelligence community does it, but really what now how a nation state like China and adversary like that of how they're able to then scale operations like this and using generative AI to their advantage. And I mean, we've seen all the, it seems like every day there's a new update and everything. I'm not sure if you watched, but yesterday, it's ongoing right now, but OpenAI is hosting their development day and it's a whole conference that's going on. And they just released a slew of new capabilities that are integrated into the OpenAI platform. And it's much broader in terms of the capabilities and everything and what you can be able to then go and do in an open AI development world versus just what most people think open AI delivers, just ChatGPT. But it's much more sophisticated than that to where now you're able to actually build agentic workflows into the OpenAI model. And that's something that was far different, not to get off topic, than what we've been having to work with, being able to leverage AI to where you've had to have multiple third-party external tools to you have to use and leverage that would build in and help automate those workflows that you're building outside of OpenAI or any kind of other large language model such as Anthropic or what's a Gemini, any of those. And then you're having to now go and have multiple different tabs open, multiple different accounts all feeding into just one. Now they've built it to where it's all in-house and it's in their own infrastructure to be able to build those workflows out. Back on track is now scaling this to be able to model these agents in a way that you would just have your intelligence professionals work and operate anyways. So if I'm a supervisor managing multiple different intelligence professionals or analysts, and in the world back just 5 years ago, I would go and instruct humans and tell them, and be like, hey, this is what you need to go and do to be able to get information on these people. And this is the way that we're going to do it. And these are the parameters of the people that we're looking for and everything. Now, you could just build that into different AI agents and have them tailored to be able to essentially operate just as that intelligence analyst would or intelligence targeter. And getting that to then you send a prompt, just like I would have a briefing or a meeting to be able to instruct all of those professionals. And now it's all working and it's in the background. It could be in just minutes of how quickly it is that each of these are gathering information, scraping the open source web to be able to gather and compile all this information, not making many mistakes, unlike what a typical human could, and then reporting that back. Because I could have a workflow to where I have all those agents discover all the information that they have, feed that into another agent to be able to compile all of it into an executive report briefing to be able to feed up to me for me to be able to read. And yeah, it's important to have that human in the loop too, of course, then be able to verify and make sure that there weren't any kind of mistakes or errors made along the way for each of those. But that just shows the scalability now, because that type, I mean, that could take days, weeks, months, however long it is to be able to compile all that information. Now you're talking, you're able to do this in a matter of minutes to get all of it. And yeah, with very minimal mistakes and very detailed notes.
It's crazy. Like, as you, yeah. I hadn't been paying attention to the OpenAI developers, their conference at all. But I think it's wild when you start looking at the ability to use AI to scale these operations and target more people, right? And figure out who to target faster. Because AI is better at man analyzing massive data sets than we are. It does it way faster. It's better at it. And so, like, of course it'll scale operations. That's crazy, man. Can you give me some examples? I know you can't, like, talk about classified things, but can you give me some examples of, either how these trainings have helped prevent, or like so just some of the things you've seen about, like, potential consequences around these. I know we talked about Robert Hansen, that's out there in public sphere, but, like, anything you can speak to that's not going to get either one of us in trouble?
Yeah, so yeah, I'll go. I won't name a specific organization of what I was working with or the time period of when this occurred to be able to narrow in on really exactly what it might have been. But yeah, during a time to where I'm delivering one of these counterintelligence and awareness and reporting briefings, and again, what those are designed for is to help educate the workforce really what counterintelligence is. People hear the word, they don't know what it means. They don't know what we do. They think we're just in a suit and tie and we're out arresting people or conducting investigations or spies, essentially. So, yeah, we got to help bridge the gap of education and transparency in terms of what we do, our capabilities that we provide, and then ultimately of what they can then do, they be in the workforce to be able to report to us and know who to report to. If they're able to detect anything that happens throughout the day, whether it's an insider threat, a different insider threat type indicators that they experience within their workforce, or an email that they receive that seems suspicious. They got to know how to report to us. And yeah, without that, then our jobs are essentially not as efficient, because we can't be everywhere all at the same at one time. And we need all those sensors, quote unquote, to be able to be out there to be able to detect for us and report. But delivering one of those briefings, I mean, every time I've delivered one, essentially someone from the workforce is coming and they're talking to me and saying, "Hey, I had experienced this. Is this something that I should have brought up or brought to someone's attention?" And it's, yeah, it. I try and be as respectful as I can, of course, because yeah, it's like it's most certainly something that we focus on and everything, but they don't know what they don't know. And yeah, I certainly always have to extend my gratitude and appreciation for them coming up and then telling me about this information. And that happens, like I said, every time after I've delivered one. Never failed for somebody to come up, come talk to me, and share that information with me. Or later on, anonymously through our tip line, to where they're sharing information after they've received one of those briefings. But yeah, I was delivering one, and literally I was on site that day, and I was like, okay, I got the information, everything. I was like, well, let's go, let's see, and actually look at this vulnerability so I can get a better understanding and everything. And go conduct these inspections. And yeah, sure enough, I'm like, yeah, this is quite the large vulnerability that we have. And we've got to make sure that this information doesn't get out. So I got to have an NDA for them to be able to sign to ensure that they're not sharing this information with anyone else outside of just the nature of their duties actually working in that area. And yeah, I bring that back to headquarters, back to the office here in DC, and I'm working on it. And then we're conducting our investigation. And not that there was a formal investigation actually launched, but an investigation to be able to gather additional details and look at the supply chain and take a really like a broad high aerial view, like 30,000 foot elevated, to be able to look down on this issue at hand. And yeah, it had direct ties back to China. And it's something like that to where like there wasn't right then and there a vulnerability yet that we had actually detect a certain that we haven't detected any sort of nefarious activity around that yet. So it's open and large vulnerability, and we don't know if this is something that China knew, if they did this on purpose, because I mean, of course they have access to it. But do they understand of the true implications of what they could do? So yeah, and that it's difficult for me to be able to
Oh, I
speak of
know.
without
I
getting
know there's
into.
so much to this story that you want to say, but I'm like, and I'd love to hear it, but I also know
Yeah,
we
and just yeah, and to add off, like to I guess end it and everything is, well, I mean, we mitigated the vulnerability. We were able to essentially save the organization from multi-millions of dollars of repercussions that would have come with that, and years worth of work that would have, it is just truly immense. And I can't get into exact details, like I said, but it was just incredible of just me going in, delivering a briefing like that, something simple and everything. And just that being able to then mitigate a multi-million dollar threat, nat large national security incident, something that would hit news headlines everywhere. And it's, yeah, it's just crazy of what is able to be stopped before just by conducting those. And that's what they're designed there for, to go and do. And yeah, it's,
That's really
that was
cool.
probably one of the more serious cases. And yeah, it just footsteps emphasizes the importance of conducting those.
Is it hard to have done all this really cool work that save, you know, that saves the country and saves organizations and but you just can't talk about it? Does that make, is that difficult?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's people all around in the intelligence community that are working some very neat stuff, and I've worked some neat stuff in my time and everything. And I mean, you tend to just not think about it. And in an initial beginning and everything, when you're working in the community, yeah, certainly has that in, like it weighs down on you in terms of, yeah, really what it is that you're out doing. and everything. And it's truly fascinating. And that's everything as to why I wanted to get into it. And yeah, there's real world implications that come. And you're working and you're one of the first lines of defense to be able to defend against it. Yeah. And as time goes on, it becomes a job and everything. So it becomes routine and it just becomes more part of your day and everything. You tend not to think about it. But there's certainly across all areas in the intelligence community where yeah, people are working very, very neat stuff, and to where they have more real world and direct and immediate impact. And most of the stuff that I was working was a lot more strategic. And when I say like research and technology protection, and you don't necessarily see the direct impact right away or immediately when there's vulnerability detected, and then you go to mitigate that eventually, hopefully. But yeah, there's a lot more, it's drawn out and everything in the world that I work in, to where yeah, you're not gonna be able to see really directly the impact and all that right then and there in your front seat.
Yeah, man. I mean, I know, I know, like, we're always thinking about, like, the next, like, preventing the next 9/11, and I'm sure we've stopped a couple of them that are like that, but we just can't even mention that they were even there or were even a possibility at all.
Yeah, there's some to where it will never reach public disclosure, just of how sensitive the information is, and also just the nature of the vulnerability. It could be something that, yeah, we don't want to publicly disclose because it hasn't been a vulnerability that we've been able to patch and mitigate yet. So yeah, that's where you're not, for national security purposes, you're not going to disclose exactly what it is that you just went and prevented. Exactly with like the case study that I just explained to you, like we can't give you the details and everything because it's still a vulnerability. I mean, it's been mitigated, but mitigated enough to where you're able to accept that risk. There's always risks and everything, and yeah, the people that are there having to have that liability, the program manager essentially working that whole project has to own that risk and be able to spend or appropriate the right resources to be able to patch and mitigate essentially that's well enough for them willing to accept essentially. But yeah, there's a lot that doesn't hit the news headlines because yeah, you don't want to disclose to the adversary, hey, this is a vulnerability, this is what was thwarted. But you could go and play that, but you're showing your cards then at that point, and it's where you could potentially foresee another attack or vulnerability or compromise all within that space if you go to disclose is that you do. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that occurs that you can't, that people are unable to take credit for. But the other times where the FBI are making arrest and yeah, compromise a well-sophisticated operation from the adversary, and being able to then show and disclose to the public to make them privy and aware to the threat that this is a real-world situation. This is actively what's going on, and to be able to get the public backing for any number of reasons.
Absolutely. And now, I mean, I know we've talked a lot about, like, defense contractors and folks in the IC, but I, as we think about, or how should we be thinking about the critical infrastructure that supports, like, the manufacturing plants where we say make bombs or tanks or what have you, the water supply, the power supply, other things that we need. How should we be thinking about that part of this, and securing this grid?
Yeah, well, I mean, let's say you have a missile and everything. I mean, you're able to essentially render that missile useless rather than having to shoot it out of the sky or having to detect on radar and be able to mitigate the threat as soon as it happens. You can just shut down the power or any of the supply that goes to manufacturing the missile, and the missile doesn't even fly then. So if you just start with that, or at the critical infrastructure to where it's actually being developed, it doesn't actually even get to the actual warfighter for them to be able to then implement into their operations.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. Can you speak to, like, how precarious it is? How close to disaster are we as it relates to things like water supply?
Yeah, it's It's crazy. And I this is what really keeps me up at night, and everything is just the amount of vulnerabilities that are out there, and really just the risks that we have here in our homeland are immense. And it comes down to just critical infrastructure like that. And not people not realize it's this is where it's better not knowing of what it like what is actually out there, because you could be able to live a much better life and everything, and one where you're able to sleep a bit better and everything. Because when you know stuff, it tends to not be good sometimes, because then it keeps you up at night. But when you think critical infrastructure and something like water, people don't know the implications of water being shut off until it actually happens, and then you're living in that. And it's something to where an adversary looks at that and was like, okay, well, what for whatever reason and whatever we want to be able to go and accomplish, what can we do to be able to shut this down, and for what reason, like what are the goals of us doing this? And I mean, something that we saw like with energy and everything in the in energy sector, there's different cyber organizations that are out there. And groups that will there be able to hack into a critical infrastructure and industrial cyber complex to be able to then leverage for ransom and be able to get payment out of it, and not turn things back on until they actually receive that payment. Often, well, exceeds what the initial investment would have been for that company organization to be able to deploy for cybersecurity. And people don't want to, business owners, CEOs, senior leaders, they don't exactly want to front the bill and the cost of proactive cybersecurity or security program until it's too late, until you have to react, and then it's multitudes of cost and what the costs are to be able to then fix what was now broken that you could have had fixed in the first place. And it's crazy, like with DC water essentially in this whole area. And really, if there is any sort of issue or contamination in the water, and it has to be shut off for any reason, the existing water supply, it would be completely run out within 7 to 8 hours, and no one in the DMV, well, I was the DC area, they wouldn't be able. I mean, you just look at the water supply, and I mean, it makes sense, which there's not anywhere else where they'd be able to draw water from. And this is just a risk that has to be willing to be accepted. You gotta have to have the proper countermeasures in place to be able to effectively work and mitigate anything that comes when something like that occurs.
So you're telling me that if there is a problem upriver in the Potomac, because the most like most of the DC area gets the water from the Potomac River, that we have a margin of error of 7 to 8 hours.
Correct.
That's
Yeah.
it. So like if something happens upriver, say tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., by the time everybody's going home from work at 5, like they could go home to a house with no
Yep. Yeah, essentially. Yeah. And I mean,
water.
there's
That's
multiple
crazy.
other areas across the US to where that's equally as true. And it's just those are risks that are out there. And it's just what you have to be able to do to accept, and different plans that are, of course, emergency management wise, that are built to be able to then work and battle with that as it comes up, to be able to mitigate and be able to get people back to normal life and a supply of water and a reasonable time.
That's wild, man. That's absolutely wild. So, now how do you if you could, and I mean, so how do you see the intersection of AI and counterintelligence continuing to develop when you think about the level of risk that we have to live with, right? You know, we mentioned water, we mentioned other programs, we mentioned R&D facilities and people being the high risk. Like, where do you see this going? Like, do you see it both being used as like offensive and then defensive from you know, like offensive from our adversaries, and we'll use the same from a defensive perspective? You may not be, I don't want you to, you may not be able to speak to that, but like, how do you see it evolving?
And this is where, I mean, of course, we Yeah, so we have an administration that's in office right now that recognizes the importance of AI. And yeah, it's something that we have to talk about greatly from a policy perspective, the legislative front, and being able to those that are working with that technology in AI, those technical experts and subject matter experts, they have to make sure that they have people that are over on Capitol Hill informing the legislators to make sure that they know of really the true benefits that you get with AI, and then implications that you receive if you try and go and restrain and control of really the progression. And that's where I'd like to focus from like counterintelligence perspective, because if we try and hinder ourselves in any way of the progression of what we're doing with AI, of course, there's implications that come with rapid progression into a technology that we don't know what it could ultimately lead to, and where you have a now you're living in the lifestyle of those crazy robot movies that are taking over. So yeah, there's got to be an equal balance, because you want to make sure that we're doing it appropriately, and yeah, it's not being done so quickly, so something like that happens. So there's got to be some regulation. But again, our adversaries, China, look at them, and they're not slowing down. They're not putting any brakes on this, and they're not going to, because they're trying to get that competitive edge and technical advantage to be able to exceed us in what we're doing. So from the national security perspective, yeah, we got to make sure like policy and policymakers are well informed that, hey, like we got to have these left and right limits. Yes, they're important, but also we don't want to hinder our innovation. And yeah, that's definitely is what is received right now over in Capitol Hill and the current administration, to be able to then incentivize, like further allow the innovation to occur, not stop it, but recognize what the risks are. And I mean, now with the risks with weapon systems and dual use technology, when you begin putting this technology into commercial products, and you're then pretty much putting out open source code of how these LLM, large language models, then work and operate for any regular commercial user to then go and equip onto something that they could make into a weapon system, essentially. And that's where you have the use of a drone that you can then have powered with the utilization of integrating multiple drones to create a swarm system, and leveraging that onto critical infrastructure or different targets that is identified by whoever that is. If it's somebody that's radicalized, a certain belief or direction, or a terrorist organization, those are all real threats that we have to look at. And it's where we're all leading towards, and it's something that we got to be able to build mechanisms and different countermeasures, such as drones, essentially, to then go and prevent and deflect any of those that are trying to target certain areas.
Yeah, man. No, it's crazy, and it's super complicated, and the risks are very high, right? And I think that I'm inclined to agree with you that it's going to continue to be used, and at AI and agentic AI to, scale these efforts and and conduct research faster, right? And I think that when you look at things like, for instance, rolling out like an AI solution into CMS, right, or the VA in, any of these other civilian agencies, I think that absolutely we need to be far more cautious, right? Because there's not at like the risks of, there are risks there, but it's not as the risks are their risks are less related to national security, and there's like a lot less that would have, like, there's also no competition, right? From like other adversaries and other powers. We're in the intel space, the counterintelligence space, and DoD space, and national security at large. We have, people like China throwing huge, huge, huge amounts of money into this and speeding development. And if we don't keep up, I think we're going to get left behind.
Yeah, certainly. And if all importance of us keeping up and everything, and going back to China with their innovations and everything, but they love to be able to take our research. They love to be able to steal the information that we're developing. And that's all of what's been going on, what's been happening. It's no secret that a lot of what their planes, their vessels all look very similar to ours, almost identical. And it's not a secret or coincidence that happened. And it's like, okay, they were able to obtain our blueprints, our schematics and designs, and be able to use and equip that and build it themselves. And it goes all the importance of having to safeguard our information as we're innovating in that space to make sure that it's proprietary and stays within our areas of control, and it's not getting exported or it's not being exploited by the adversary China or any others alike that are then using to their advantage. Because now if they get the information and all the different capabilities that we have that we just appropriated all of our budget towards and appropriations towards R&D, research and development, now they can take what we just overall developed, spent billions of dollars trying to create. Now they can just apply their R&D funds and appropriations on top of what our final product was to now expand that even further and get ahead. And that's exactly what's going on. And it's a serious issue where it's important, like for us at counterintelligence, to then be able to share that out to the workforce, because we have vulnerabilities like that occur every day, and they're all here in the US and globally too. And we got to be able to inform everyone of those real world threats and implications.
Absolutely. And I just did a whole episode about the cost of intellectual property theft a couple of months ago, right? As you
Oh,
look at
really? How was that?
it was awesome, man. I'll send it over to you. Really, really cool. I had lucky to have awesome Josh Teal on to talk about it. He just started his own AI company, West Point grad, long time in the military, doing some really cool stuff. But just look at like what we're doing about it, I think, is what he said was like nothing. We're not really addressing that in geopolitical affairs, and that's crazy to me. Like, but as you think about, the last question I do have for you, Matt, is as you think about all of this, and you think about not just like the IP theft, but also counterintelligence in general. Like, if you have a message for lawmakers or policymakers, like, what would you say, and what advice would you give to them as somebody that's had boots on the ground for a couple decades?
Oh, so much. It was like, I don't even have like just one thing. Like, I guess it just, if I could say one, it would, for more precedence to be able to be placed and the pr more proactive stuff that we can be able to then go and do and appropriate resources in that, in those areas, in that direction for counterintelligence. And yeah, I mean, there's quite the large budget that the counterintelligence does receive across the entire community, but it differs across organizations in terms of how much they're going to be able to then go and use, because the organizations may not know of the benefits of what they're able to then receive from counterintelligence. And when you look at all the way down from the program level of a program manager, and they're working with the budget and everything, and they don't even know what counterintelligence is or means. And that's something that I faced at the Coast Guard when I was working there, and I was working directly with each of these major acquisition programs and speaking directly with the program managers to inform them of what it is that we do and how we have certain capabilities that they can then leverage, and capabilities that they have that we are different information that they have that they're working on that will help benefit us to be able to work our operations, our mission. And when you scale that up all the way to the policy level, they need to understand and recognize that as well. So when they know of the true benefits and the return on investment really of what they're getting when they appropriate more resources, a greater budget. And it's not always easy asking for more money. Everybody's asking for money. But it's something to where you're able to back with statistics and historical trends or actual case study examples of, hey, this is something that really it didn't cost much to go and do, and the return on investment of what you get is pretty much saving millions of dollars on the back end, preventing an actual incident. But oftentimes what you go and experience is people, leaders, they may not want to spend more money on something that actually hasn't happened yet. So it's not real, it's not a tangible issue to them, and there's many other things that they can go and spend their money on. But that's where it's all the more importance to be able to reiterate, hey, this, like, the ROI on this is immense in terms of just what little more that you could be able to put towards to be able to then protect and save millions later on. And I think that would be the thing I would want to be able to get across, is them to be able to understand the true gravity and importance of counterintelligence and how well it's built into the national security system to be able to prevent stuff from happening, serious incidents. Because there's many other things that you could be able to then go and share of specific instances where they could be able to really deliver money towards and deploy that capital. But really, just understanding the foundational concepts and principles of what it is that we do as counterintelligence professionals to be able to convey that message to them to be able to understand.
There's no point in paying for R&D if the R&D is just going to get stolen. This is protecting our investment.
And then once you build off of that, okay, now what are all the areas and what are the different gaps that we need to fill to be able to ensure that, yeah, this is going to be more airtight, sealed, and everything to where information is not going to be getting out. And I mean, as much as I'm for collaboration, everything like in an academic and research space, we got to be careful in terms of those that we're sharing information with. And yeah, in an academia world, you want to be able to bounce ideas off one another, share information, and really talk about your findings and your research. And yeah, that's a great thing that you want to be able to share. But you got to be able to know at the end of the day who it is that you're sharing with. Conduct your own due diligence to be able to know, like, what is it that they're trying to gain out of this? Is it for a nefarious purpose, or is it something that we're all working towards a common goal and objective that is pledges allegiance to, yeah, our nation and everything, not to someone else?
Yeah, man. Really appreciate it, Matt. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining. Any points you wanted to make or anything I forgot to ask?
No, I just, yeah, I appreciate you having me on for the talk and discussion. Yeah, it was great and being able to touch on each of those topics. And yeah, I just want to be able to help spread this message and everything out to people that are engaged in this space or interested in these topics. And yeah, it's a great segment for discussion and everything. And yeah, I really appreciate you having me on, and for people then be able to listen and hear what it is that we had to discuss.
Yeah, man. And really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time. And everybody, thank you all for listening to Robust and Red Tape. I really hope you're having a great day.